each other over prerogatives and power, resembled an archipelago of urban islands supplied by hopping airplanes and helicopters, engulfed by a sea of guerrilla country. The state's geometry resembled the archipelago of communist-controlled cities the Soviet Union had left behind in 1989, when CIA-backed Mujahideen rebels ruled the countryside before they finally took Kabul in 1992. Somewhere between 1,000 and 3,000 fighters in the armed opposition to Ghani's government now fought under the banner of the Islamic State, mainly in eastern Nangarhar province. They constituted no more than 10% of the country's guerrilla forces. Nearly all the rest remained officially loyal to the Taliban. The Islamic State strengthened in Afghanistan after NATO's withdrawal from combat operations at the end of 2014, in part because its recruiters exploited confusion over whether Mullah Muhammad Omar was alive or dead. The Taliban's media operation kept insisting that Omar was alive and well, and issued statements in his name. But in July 2015, Uthman Ghazi, the leader of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, the terrorist organization long affiliated with al-Qaeda, put out a statement declaring that Mullah Muhammad Omar was dead and that the IMU would now pledge allegiance to the Islamic State. When Uzbek and allied fighters attacked Taliban-held villages, they used loudspeakers to lure defectors, shouting, "Mullah Omar is dead," where they managed to take control of villages and districts near the Pakistan border. They imitated the ruthless methodology of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Fighters beheaded Afghan Hazaras, who followed the Shia sect of Islam, en masse. They executed other hostages by bomb and distributed digital videos of their carnage online. In August, to shore up their position, the Taliban, or ISI, at last admitted publicly that Mullah Muhammad Omar had died in April 2013, more than 2 years before. After a brief succession struggle, a Taliban shura appointed Omar's deputy, Mullah Akhtar Muhammad Mansur, as the new emir. It had been Mansur who directed Tayyip Aga's secret negotiations with the Obama administration, and it was he who had apparently coordinated with Ashfaq Kayani and ISI to produce draft statements under Omar's name at a time when the Taliban's founding leader lay dying in a Karachi hospital. In May 2016, less than a year after he officially took charge of the Taliban, Mullah Mansur was killed by an American drone in Balochistan, Pakistan, as Mansur returned from Iran in a small convoy of sport utility vehicles. It wasn't clear why the Taliban's new emir had been visiting Iran. The Taliban's Deobandi creed of Sunni Islam is anathema to Iran's Shiite theologians. In 2000, the Taliban and Iran grew so hostile toward one another that they almost fought a war. After 2001, Iran improved relations with the Taliban, however, to help the movement defeat the United States. Iran's evident motive was to hasten the withdrawal of American troops and aircraft from bases located so close to Tehran. More recently, a new wrinkle had entered into Taliban-Iranian relations. Both the Taliban and Tehran feared the rise of the Islamic State. It would make sense if Mansur had visited Iran to receive support or even plan joint operations against this shared enemy, just as they had collaborated against Washington. In any event, after American intelligence officers tracked Mansur and eliminated him, a hardline cleric from Kandahar, Malawi Haibatullah Hakunzada, succeeded to power as the Taliban's third emir. In late 2016, there were still about 8,400 American troops stationed in Afghanistan. About a quarter of them were counter-terrorist forces engaged in direct attacks against any groups officially designated as terrorists by the United States. According to the Pentagon, there were 13 foreign terrorist organizations, as they were officially labeled under U.S. law, with followers in Afghanistan. There were another 7 in Pakistan. Altogether, this stew of 20 or so groups amounted to about a fifth of all the foreign terrorist organizations worldwide. Early in 2016, President Obama expanded this aspect of the American war in Afghanistan. He added the local Islamic State affiliate to the counter-terrorist mission and authorized direct American strikes against its guerrillas. The rest of the 6,000-plus U.S. force in Afghanistan provided advise and assist support to Afghan forces against the Taliban, or delivered logistics, intelligence, and transport to both military campaigns. The Pentagon estimated that the Taliban and the Islamic State together controlled about 10% of Afghan territory outright. The CIA estimated that it was more like one-third. Either way, it was clear that more than half of the Afghan population, mainly in cities, lived under the government's writ, however shaky that writ might be. Kidnapping gangs menaced Kabul and abducted Westerners for ransom or to sell them on to the Haqqani network in Waziristan. Hundreds of thousands of urbanized young Afghan men voted with their feet after 2014 and undertook perilous migrations overland to Europe. It was possible to make a case that this stalemate required, and might eventually reward, continued investments of American support. For one thing, a full withdrawal would all but assure the Taliban's triumph. The arguments made by Pentagon commanders who advocated for remaining in the Afghan war, and possibly even expanding American involvement, held that a stalemate might be good enough for now. They argued that the Afghan forces' fitful progress and the continued American counter-terrorist mission there should be evaluated in a worldwide context. There were many dangerous, ambitious terrorist groups in the Afghan region. The United States required forward bases to check them. The Afghan state was weak, corrupt, and politically paralyzed, it was true, but so were the governments of other emerging nations racked by internal violence. The military stalemate in Afghanistan, these commanders argued, resembled Mexico's struggles with narco-traffickers, or Colombia's long war with the FARC, or Nigeria's internal conflicts with Boko Haram and southern oil smugglers. These had been, or remained, long, messy, shifting wars, but conflicts where the state, however fragmented and corrupt, remained more or less intact, cooperated with the United States in Europe, received development aid, and repressed terrorists. If the United States remained committed to Afghanistan, these Pentagon commanders would tell President Donald Trump, the government in Kabul might never eliminate armed guerrillas or the Taliban's leadership, but it might achieve an acceptable state of equilibrium and slow progress that would keep the country free from reign by the Taliban or the Islamic State, and prevent any rekindling of Al-Qaeda or its ilk on Afghan territory. Eventually, the war might yield peace negotiations, as in Colombia. Trump had advocated for withdrawal from Afghanistan, but in August 2017, he accepted the arguments of his generals and announced that his administration would stay committed to the Afghan war. It was a long way from the modernizing, transforming visions for Afghanistan that had characterized the hubristic heights of the good war. But even as a template for realism, the Pentagon's vision strained credulity. The rates of casualties and attrition in Afghan forces had already weakened them badly. If this cycle of combat and casualties went on for a few more years, the forces were likely to break down. Also, the Afghan army, the police, and the NDS increasingly were politicized, influenced by Kabul factions and ethnic polarization, and undermined by the paralysis between Ghani and Abdullah. It was hard to imagine how another Afghan presidential election, scheduled for 2019, could improve matters, given the record of the previous two elections. President Ghani's initial plan had been to reduce the war's violence through reconciliation talks with the Taliban and Pakistan, but these efforts had proved to be as treacherous and unproductive for his administration as they had been for the Obama administration's conflict resolution cell. On the other side of the war, ISI's support for the Taliban remained steadfast. Ashfaq Kayani finally retired as Chief of Army Staff at the end of November 2013. General Raheel Sharif, his successor, extended the Army's influence over Pakistani media and foreign policy. During Sharif's tenure, American commanders in Afghanistan detected no change in Kayani's policies of support and sanctuary for the Taliban. By 2016, Major General Mohammad Wasim Ashraf reportedly ran ISI's Directorate S. On the Afghan front of external operations, his bureau seemed to follow a policy of providing as much support for the Taliban as ISI could get away with, just enough to keep the war broiling, while avoiding aid so explicit that it might provoke the international community to impose sanctions on Pakistan or withdraw military sales. The new Pakistan Army regime also continued Kayani's post-Abbottabad policy of probing the possibilities for peace talks with Kabul and increasing reliance on China for economic, military, and nuclear aid. In August 2016, a helicopter crashed in Logar Province, Afghanistan, in Taliban country to the south of Kabul. The helicopter was painted white, apparently to resemble the helicopters flown by contractors supporting the Kabul government. A Russian pilot and Pakistani military officers were aboard, by some accounts, although there were reports as well that the pilot was a Pakistani-educated British citizen. Taliban commanders facilitated the crew's return to Islamabad within days and burned the helicopter. It was not fully clear whether its supplies were meant for the Taliban or rival Islamic State factions. Pakistan put out an absurd story that the helicopter was on its way to Central Asia for repairs. The area where the aircraft went down has been a supply corridor since the early 1990s from Pakistan for ISI officers aiding guerrillas attacking Kabul. A series of valleys shielded by mountains and gorges provide relatively safe passage for helicopters. Still, ISI's apparent willingness to defy NATO by sanctioning direct covert helicopter supply flights to the Taliban or the Islamic State provided striking evidence of the service's sense of impunity. For his part, Ashfaq Kayani retired in the Islamabad area, kept a modest profile, and occasionally turned up in civilian dress for conferences about military and foreign policy. Reportedly, some of his family moved to Australia. His former partner at ISI, Ahmed Pasha, considered writing a book about his experiences in the military, but in the meantime wrote in Urdu about early Pakistani history. Maliha Lodi, Kayani's political advisor, became Pakistan's ambassador to the United Nations. Following a conflict with Pasha and ISI that saw him placed under a form of house arrest for a time, Hussein Haqqani moved back to the United States and wrote forthrightly in opposition to the Pakistan Army's political influence and ISI's coddling of extremists. The American specialists who shaped and debated the country's longest war moved on. Kofor Black joined Blackwater after retiring from government and later joined another CIA contractor as an executive. Rich Blee retired and went into security consulting with Hank Crumpton. Steve Kappas also worked with a private firm involved in intelligence analysis and software. Greg Vogel remained at the CIA, was promoted into the Senior Intelligence Service, and ran the CIA's paramilitary division during the second Obama term. He eventually retired and joined former General Stan McChrystal's consulting firm. In 2015, Chris Wood, also now the equivalent of a three-star general, worked alongside Vogel after succeeding Mike D'Andrea as chief of the CIA's counterterrorism center. He retired about 2 years later. Some of the Bush administration's architects of Afghan policy remained involved with the country during the Obama years. Zalmay Khalilzad formed a business with offices on K Street in Washington, D.C., from which he invested in the Middle East and Afghanistan. He also published a memoir. Robert Finn became a lecturer in Turkish history and studies at Princeton University. Following a Taliban attack on the American University of Afghanistan in the late summer of 2016, David Sedney agreed to serve as acting president of the university. He also joined an effort to shore up international commitments to Afghanistan through a group called the Alliance in Support of the Afghan People. During the Obama years, Steve Hadley worked with John Podesta, the Democratic strategist, who would become Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign chairman, on a program by the United States Institute for Peace to support democratic Afghan politics and the 2014 Afghan presidential election. Elliot Cohen returned to Johns Hopkins University. David Kilcullen started a consulting firm and published several books. Brian Glenn Williams also published several books while remaining on the faculty of the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. At the DIA, Dave Smith ran Pakistan analysis for several years before retiring. After the secret Taliban negotiations collapsed, President Obama appointed Doug Loot as the United States ambassador to NATO, where he served until the end of Obama's time in office. Jeff Hayes left Loot's staff to return to DIA. Successively, Jeff Eggers and then Peter Lavoie followed Loot at the National Security Council as Barack Obama's principal specialists on Pakistan and Afghanistan. Lavoie remained in that role until the administration's end, then joined ExxonMobil as an advisor about Asia. Frank Ruggiero ran government relations in Washington for BAE Systems, a British defense company. At the State Department, Ann Patterson became the U.S. ambassador to Egypt and then Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East. Cameron Munter left government and became chief executive of the East-West Institute. Mark Grossman returned to business consulting. Barnett Rubin returned to his position at the Center on International Cooperation at New York University. Mark Sageman returned to writing about terrorism and served as an expert witness at several terrorism trials. In addition to consulting and publishing a memoir, Stan McChrystal taught at Yale. David Petraeus pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor for mishandling classified information and joined a large private equity firm in New York. Mike Mullen joined the board of directors of General Motors. Michael Flynn stunned some former colleagues by joining Donald Trump's campaign for the presidency as an outspoken national security advisor. At the Republican Party convention in Cleveland, he stood on stage and joined the delegates in lock-her-up chants directed at Hillary Clinton. Trump then named him national security advisor in his new administration. He was soon fired after allegations surfaced that he had misled Vice President Mike Pence about contacts with Russian officials. General John Allen joined Hillary Clinton's campaign and spoke at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Hamid Karzai lived for the most part in a cobble compound behind high walls near the presidential palace, received visitors, and was continually rumored to be meddling in Afghan politics. He gave interviews criticizing the United States for undermining Afghan sovereignty and insisted, as ever, that there would be no war in Afghanistan if not for Pakistan and ISI. "We are victims," he said. When the Taliban finally admitted that Mullah Omar was dead, Tayyip Aga resigned as Omar's supposed negotiator to avoid expected future disputes, as he put it. He continued to spend time in Qatar. An array of other Taliban leaders joined fitful peace discussions organized by Pakistan after 2014. They made no progress. For the Panjshiri commanders and aides who huddled in the garden of a hospital in Tajikistan in September 2001, debating how to manage the news of Commander Ahmad Shah Massoud's assassination, the decade and a half following September 11th was transforming, and, for many in the Panjshiri leadership, enriching. Nearly all of Massoud's aides held cabinet or parliamentary offices during the Karzai years, at one time or another. After he left NDS, Amrullah Saleh organized a grassroots movement focused on youth and nationalism. He became active on Twitter. In 2017, he returned to government to oversee reforms of the Afghan security services. President Ghani appointed Engineer Arif as governor of Panjshir province. Marshal Fahim died of a heart attack on March 9, 2014, at the age of 57. His family and followers erected a grand marble tomb on a barren hillside on the road from Kabul to Panjshir. It is visible from miles away, resembling the memorial of a Mughal emperor. The wealth Fahim and his family accumulated after 2001 was visible, too, in his hometown, Omars, where he left behind, beside the Panjshir River, a magnificent compound resembling a palace. The entrance to the Panjshir Valley, near Jabal Saraj, suggests an illustration from a Tolkien novel. The turquoise mountain waters of the Panjshir River, foaming white, roar through a steep and narrow rock gorge toward the Somali plain below. The sheer walls and boulders at the valley's mouth create natural gates and barriers that would be difficult for even a heavily armored convoy to breach. Beyond this stone barricade, the valley is narrow and protected by high, steep walls for several miles. On the eve of September 11th, this constituted the front line for Massoud and his holdout Panjshiri forces, one of the last redoubts against full Taliban control of Afghanistan. Almost 16 years later, Panjshir was again preparing its defenses. As Ghani and Abdullah struggled to govern, as NATO governments and voters questioned the cost and trajectory of aid to Afghanistan, it was hard to avoid the possibility that the Afghan war might be cycling back toward where it began before the American intervention following September 11th. The Panjshir looks again to be a defiant redoubt against the Taliban, alongside Hazara areas in the country's central mountains and some other regions of the north. After the Taliban's insurgency revived in 2005, the movement's commanders have occasionally tried to raid the Panjshir Valley, whether for revenge or glory or sport. Even though the valley's population is ethnically homogeneous and unified in its hostility toward the Taliban and its allies, no Taliban commander or suicide bomber has made it more than a few kilometers up the road from Jabal Saraj before achieving martyrdom. The Panjshiris' participation in the American-led victory over the Taliban in 2001 has brought the valley many economic rewards, even if corruption and theft by Massoud's lieutenants has diluted the benefits for ordinary farmers and shopkeepers. The main road running north from Jabal Saraj through the valley toward Tajikistan is asphalted and in fine repair. There are new schools and supermarkets groaning with grapes and melons. The Panjshiris' position as an inner circle of American allies, capable under arms, for the most part reliable under pressure, created many business opportunities in security contracting, transportation contracting, and logistics during the surges of American troops into the country. New stone houses and farms line the river today, ringed by barbed wire, constructed by the valley families that benefited from war and reconstruction. Yet the Panjshir's political and military leadership has fragmented since 2001. The successor to Massoud, elected in the hospital garden, Marshal Fahim, is gone. None of Massoud's other former lieutenants can command widespread authority, including Abdullah, who is increasingly dismissed by Panjshiri colleagues as a self-interested opportunist. The ideal of Panjshiri solidarity is held together in large measure by a ghostly symbolic image, Massoud's mournful face, which remains ubiquitous in Kabul and the valley, in blown-up photographs and posters taped onto the windshields of Corollas and armored land cruisers, plastered on billboards and in market windows, and at virtually every checkpoint or bridge. The persistence and mobilizing power of Massoud's memory is impressive, yet there is a threadbare quality about his hold on Panjshiri loyalties. 15 years after his death, a massive shrine on a mountain hilltop outside of his hometown of Bazarak remains unfinished, a testament to flawed leadership and corruption among his followers. The more time goes on, the more evident it becomes that the public cult of the valley's martyred hero remains essential because of the absence of credible living leadership. There are contenders for next-generation political military command of the Panjshir, in Massoud's tradition, should the war require a return to guerrilla fighting. Amrullah Saleh is one credible possibility. In recent years, Saleh has built a whitewashed home by the rushing water of the Panjshir, just below Massoud's unfinished shrine. He can look up at his mentor's tomb from his front porch. Another possibility is Ahmad Shah Massoud's only male heir. Devoted to the anti-Soviet war, Massoud married relatively late, in 1988, to the daughter of a Panjshiri commander whose family had lived near his own in the valley for perhaps a century. Masood's wife delivered a son, Ahmad, in the year following their union. They had 5 more children together, all daughters. During the early and mid-1990s, including a few dark years after the Taliban took Kabul, Ahmad lived with his mother in Vazarak, in the heart of the Panjshir Valley. The boy served tea in his father's radio room and slept in a small room with all of his sisters and the occasional caregiver. As the only boy in a famous commander's family, Ahmad received a lot of attention. When the war became rougher by 1998, when Taliban jets occasionally bombed Panjshir, Masood shifted his family to Tajikistan and Iran. Ahmad was just 12 years old when Al-Qaeda assassinated his father in September 2001. His mother and uncles groomed him for succession. After high school, he considered attending West Point, but decided instead on Sandhurst, the British military academy, where he could combine military training with university study at King's College in London, which is well known for its war studies department. Ahmad wrote a thesis about whether the Taliban were better understood as a criminal network than an ethno-nationalist or ideological movement. He concluded they were criminals. He stayed on at City University to earn a master's degree before returning to Afghanistan in 2016. Ahmad Masood was now 27 years old. In Kabul, he met a senior CIA officer that summer. The officer told him, "We made 2 mistakes. We should have listened to your father's warnings about Al-Qaeda, and we should never have let you go to Sandhurst instead of West Point or an American university." Ahmad's plan was to work at the philanthropic Masood Foundation for a while and travel the country to build up his public profile before considering an entry into Afghan politics. There are already efforts underway to raise his visibility. On the main road from Kabul to Panjshir, in Charka, the capital of Parwan province, supporters have mounted a large billboard depicting Ahmad's photograph alongside his father's. "Looking at you makes us remember our beloved one," it says. In September 2016, a few days before the 15th anniversary of his father's death, Ahmad Masood rode in a Land Cruiser to the valley to visit with supporters and family. On a day bathed in bright sunshine, he met a visitor in Vazarak, on a friend's open porch beside Panjshir River Rapids. Ahmad wore a trimmed beard and a pressed, embroidered gown. He is self-possessed, a strong speaker, with a Roman chin and nose. His resemblance to his father is unmistakable. Yet he does not exude great interest in warfare. He learned leadership and military tactics at Sandhurst, but also discovered that he hates horses. He has allergies and struggles with an ankle that he once fractured playing soccer. His intention is not to try to live up to his father's reputation as a genius at war, which would be a formidable task, but to convert his father's influence to improve next-generation democratic politics in Afghanistan. "The main thing is that I want to forget about the past," he said. "I want to be part of a generation of peacemakers." Yet his father's followers seek out Ahmad as their general against the revived Taliban. When the northern city of Kunduz fell briefly to the Taliban, in the late summer of 2015, the incursion set off a panic in the province and in Kabul. Ahmad was still studying in London. His cell phone rang daily as Kunduz residents pleaded for him to come home. "What's your plan?" they asked. "What's your goal?" "We respected your father. We will follow you." Ahmad's mother also called him. "Ahmad, what are you doing?" she asked. "I don't care about your studies. I expect you to be on the front lines of Kunduz." He paused to reflect on these expectations. "This was my own mother," he noted. He had an out, as it happened. His passport was with British Immigration when the Kunduz crisis erupted, and by the time it was returned to him, the government had retaken the city. But this was just a temporary reprieve. "I don't want a bubble just around myself," Ahmad went on, beside the river. I want this generation to carry the message and the vision of my father. When my father was there, he was Minister of Defense, he continued, referring to Ahmad Shah Massoud's position in the Mujahideen government before the Taliban took Kabul in 1996. He had an army and a network of commanders. I don't have any of those things. You can't say that to people who are suffering, however. Afghanistan remained at war. The Taliban remained a vicious enemy, and there were new threats to Panjshir and the country now, such as the Islamic State. He was Commander Massoud's only son, educated at Sandhurst. Next time, he asked, what am I going to do when the people knock on my door? This is Malcolm Hilgartner. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, by Steve Cole.